Hi, I'm Corey, and I'm eating Jack's frozen pizza while losing some dignity in Glenview, Illinois, and you're listening to Outside the Loop Radio, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Hey, no shame. Embrace that, Corey. Enjoy the pizza. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 954. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio. So hello to Bob. And coming up on the show today, we discover the secret history of a local underground counterculture band. Interesting. Also, we live next to a treasure, Lake Michigan. Today, we learn about the efforts to preserve the health of Lake Michigan and all the Great Lakes, and government has a role in that, and that can be a good thing. Well, what a week it's been. We started off in a deep freeze, and comparatively, today it's time to bust out the Hawaiian shirts, right? And one or two things happened on a national level, didn't they? Yep, we have a new president and administration, and maybe that excites you, or maybe that makes you feel a sense of unease, anger, and frustration. In any event, here we are, and what we choose to do going forward makes a difference. Specifically, working at the local level. There are so many people in our area who are doing important and difficult work in order to benefit others. There's a lot of talk about immigration, especially in Chicago these days. Chicago is a city of immigrants, and we rely on them. Also, they are people. That might sound obvious, but we get so caught up in all of the national security stuff and possibly taking away jobs that we forget that we're talking about human beings. And many of these folks are doing jobs that nobody else wants to do, frankly. There are local organizations who are reaching out to our immigrant community, and many in that community are scared right now, and they need that outreach because their future is uncertain. The local work continues with a topic like the environment. I said that we're talking about the preservation of the Great Lakes on the show today. Part of that preservation begins with us at the local level. Local organizations help alert the government of pollution impacts, and they advocate for a cleaner Great Lakes ecosystem. Neighborhood groups advocate for change on a block-by-block level, fighting against industry and pollution in their backyard. These are just two examples of how we can get involved, and I do encourage you to get involved in something that interests you or motivates you or just fires you up. I continue to say that we are lucky to live where we live. There are opportunities for us to take action, to get involved in making this a better place. So whatever you're feeling this week about the state of our country and where we are headed, I encourage you to engage with one another. Listen to each other and try to have some empathy for those in our community. I'm happy you're here. I'm happy to be here. Now, on to the show. We are incredibly lucky to live so close to Lake Michigan, and we are lucky to have the Great Lakes more generally. Millions of us depend on the Great Lakes for drinking water, and the world depends on the Great Lakes as an environmental resource. It does take some work on our part, however, to make sure that the Great Lakes are healthy. That's where the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative comes in. This has been reintroduced in the U.S. House of Representatives and is a bipartisan bill. Don Jodry is the Director of Federal Government Relations at the Alliance for the Great Lakes. That's a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization working to protect the Great Lakes. The website is greatlakes.org, and Don is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Don, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here today to talk about the Great Lakes.
Yeah, they are really something. And I said, hey, here we are in Chicago and Chicagoland. We're pretty much right on the banks of Lake Michigan here. And I think this is amazing that the Great Lakes contain about 22% of the world's fresh water. That's an amazing statistic. And I think that sometimes in living so close to Lake Michigan, a great lake, sometimes we take it for granted. Sometimes we forget about it. So just remind us here at the outset, I rattled off some stats here, but the significance of the Great Lakes and us being so close to them.
Well, you know, I think you just mentioned it. Really, the primary issue here is the amount of fresh water in the Great Lakes. It's truly an amazing natural resource for the United States and Canada. And a couple other big statistics are, you know, it serves as the source of drinking water for over 33 million Americans. It powers an economy in the region that has over 26 million jobs, with $1.3 trillion in wages. And it's just an amazing sort of engine for the region's economy, as well as a wonderful environmental resource for the folks that live in the Great Lakes region across eight states. So truly, it truly is the Great Lakes.
Yeah. I mean, so many of us are impacted by the Great Lakes. We mentioned the fresh water, the drinking water, but the environmental goal that we have here is just incredible. And so your organization, the Alliance for the Great Lakes, let's talk briefly about what you do. So tell us how this organization came about and what it is that you actually do.
Well, sure. Our organization has been around for about 50 years. We're based in Chicago, but we have staff throughout the region and several of the states. I'm actually in Washington, D.C. So we're 50 years old, and we started as the Lake Michigan Federation in the early 70s. And one of the first things we worked on was the enactment of the Clean Water Act, because back at that time, you know, we didn't have federal protections for our water bodies and things like the Cuyahoga River were, you know, were on fire.
Right.
And so there was a national impetus. And that was one of the big environmental laws in the 70s was the Clean Water Act. So that's how our organization got started. At some point, we changed our name to the Alliance for the Great Lakes. And we really our purpose is to really, work to protect and restore the Great Lakes, to sort of promote programs that do that throughout the region.
And so the fact that they need protection, I mean, let's just focus on that for a second here, because your organization, I think, is great and does some very important work to protect this amazing natural resource here. But let's think about some of the tension that exists here, because if you're driving from Chicago and you're going through, say, Gary, Indiana on the Skyway, and you see all the industry, not just in Gary, but also sort of around the bend there. And I've done this many times, and I think to myself, oh, you know what? I don't know. There's a lot of factories right in the water, essentially, and they can't be spewing out good things in the water. But on the other hand here, we want factories and we want places to be successful. We want there to be industry. So what is that sort of tension between industry and protecting business and but also protecting the environment? Can you speak to how that tension kind of exists?
Well, sure. And that exists everywhere in the country, right? You know, we always have a tension between the environment and the economy. We need to have a healthy environment to have a healthy economy. And we need to have water that's safe to drink and safe to recreate in, air that's safe to breathe. And that's the fundamental tension between our natural environment as well as any area that has sort of human development. And you mentioned the amount of industrial manufacturing around the Great Lakes. And that is one of the reasons and one of the legacies that led to the enactment of the Clean Water Act and some of the other environmental statutes, is to try to protect our natural resources. So you see that tension pretty clearly in the Great Lakes, where you have that interface between the natural system and the human developed system. The goal really is to find sort of a sustainability so you can do things to have both a healthy environment and a healthy economy. We're basically in the business of, you know, fixing the wrongs of the past. That's what this is about. And that's what our organization is pushing for, is programs that try to redress some of these harms and these legacy pollution issues and things like that.
So let's talk about, kind of with that as a backdrop, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative Act. I mentioned that this is a bipartisan bill. This has been reintroduced in the U.S. House. So what exactly does this do?
Well, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is one of those federal programs that's really important to the Great Lakes. It's been around for about 14 years. It was first started in 2010. And as its name implies, it's a program that's geared towards restoring and protecting the Great Lakes. There are a number of program areas it addresses, which is sort of toxic legacy pollution, invasive species, non-point source pollution, restored habitat, and sort of other sort of actions like science and investigations to sort of make sure that we're addressing the needs of the day. It's been around, as I said, for 14 years. Over that time period, it's funded over 7,500 projects around the Great Lakes region to address some of these issues. In terms of federal funding, it's about $3.7 billion in terms of an investment. And it's done some very important things over that time period in terms of restoring river miles and watersheds, restoring habitat, addressing invasive species issues, and the removal of toxic legacy sediments. The importance of the bill is basically to make sure that the program is reauthorized and continued for another 5 years. So typically when Congress passes a piece of legislation like this, it's for a specific period of time that Congress authorizes the program, and it authorizes the appropriation of federal monies to be invested. And Congress comes back and revisits that periodically. So the current authorization for the program expires in 2026. So folks in the House side have introduced a bill that would reauthorize that program for another 5 years. And I'm expecting that the Senate is going to introduce a bill in the next month or so. And this will be one of our top priorities for this Congress, is to get that program reauthorized and have the president sign it into law.
And this really does involve people on the ground. I mean, here we are talking about legislation, but you talked about the programs that exist and the importance of this this initiative here. But what we're specifically talking about, people on the ground who are taking action, who go and test and try to fix things. I mean, that's, we're mobilizing people through this legislation, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. This legislation funds projects throughout the Great Lakes region to address these issues that I talked about earlier. And it can be a project in Illinois or Indiana or Wisconsin or Minnesota or New York, but it's going to have some kind of on-the-ground impact and benefit. And I think, you know, we've done some economic studies in the last 5 years that show that for every dollar we invest, we get $3.50 of economic return. So it has a positive rate of return. It's done in partnership with all the Great Lakes states and tribes and local communities. In fact, and the way the funds are awarded is EPA gives about half of the funds they get every year to about 16 other federal agencies that all have an interest in the Great Lakes. And the money is spent pursuant to a plan. And it's basically, as you said, achieving on-the-ground results throughout the region.
You are, Don, the Director of Federal Government Relations. So you're talking to a lot of elected representatives, and you are interfacing with our government. So I have to ask you this. I mean, just in the context of where we are right now, we have a new administration, we have a new Congress. So how are you approaching working with this Congress on environmental issues? Because I think about the president on day one rolled back through executive action some environmental regulations from the Biden administration. And we've seen some picks for the EPA that have some sort of connections to companies who are polluting. So with that in mind, how are you approaching working with this Congress in terms of protecting the Great Lakes?
Well, that's a great question. And I think the way I think about it, and you just pointed out that this administration, the Trump administration, is going to have different priorities from the Biden administration, is going to do things differently and propose things that are different. And some of those things are going to have negative consequences for our natural resources in the Great Lakes, and some of them will not. But the way we approach it, in terms of the way I approach sort of lobbying and advocacy for the Great Lakes, is I approach the folks in Congress, whether they're Republican or Democrat, with the facts and sort of why we think that they should do something. The one thing that's really positive about the Great Lakes delegation and all the different states is it's incredibly bipartisan on some issues. And on this particular issue that we're talking about, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, there is a lot of bipartisan support for this program. We have Republicans and Democrats in the House and Senate that are very, very happy and pleased with how this program has been unfolding over the last 14 years. And they really place a lot of value in it, and they really want to see it continue. And what's interesting is the Trump administration, you just mentioned that they're doing things this week. The one thing I'll note is when they came in, you know, the first Trump administration actually proposed to zero out this program twice in their budget submission. They wanted to defund it, and the Congress didn't go along with that. And finally, after two passes of trying to get rid of the program, the Trump administration realized that there was a lot of congressional support for it, and they proposed money for it in the budget. So I don't think the Trump administration is going to propose to reduce funding or eliminate this program. But, you know, I'm cautious to not make that a certain thing. It's possible that they may still try to do that. But I'm just trying to point out that in the Congress, in the 119th Congress, there is a lot of bipartisan support for this. And so in terms of trying to get it reauthorized, we're doing what we always do, which is go up and meet with the members and their staff, point out why this is important, why it's important for their district, and hopefully move it through the legislative process. The bill was introduced in the last Congress, in the 118th. It passed in the Senate on a bipartisan basis. I think it was 98-0. It didn't make it through the House, in part because I think some of the folks on the relevant committee of jurisdiction felt that it was early. You know, as I said, the program doesn't expire until 2026. They were trying to pass legislation last year. So it didn't advance in the House like it did in the Senate. So I'm thinking that this time around in the 119th, with the deadline of 2026, I'm hopeful for a successful outcome.
I think it's something to keep in mind here, because what you're saying, you're working with Republicans and Democrats. And look, sometimes in the national conversation, we stereotype, we make assumptions about certain political parties. But really here, these environmental issues, they don't care if you're a Republican or a Democrat. They're still going to be impactful no matter what. And what I'm hearing you say is, you know, for all of what we think about Democrats and Republicans, these members, for the most part, are pretty receptive to what you're saying here, looking at the evidence, looking at the facts. And sometimes we don't hear that, you know, but what I'm hearing you say is that they agree that we need to be protecting this resource.
That's exactly right. And I think water generally, and I've heard, you know, we've heard some positive things from folks in the Trump administration about the importance of clean water. So I'm hopeful that water will be more of a bipartisan issue than some of the other ones that you know, you hear about or read about every day. But I do think it's important to stress that sometimes these natural resource issues do get a lot of bipartisan support, particularly when they're localized on resources like this, like the Great Lakes. You know, you find this around the country, you know, Puget Sound, Long Island Sound, the Chesapeake Bay, the Florida Everglades. You will find a lot of bipartisan support for these sorts of regional ecosystem programs because of their importance to the local economy. And I think that's why this particular program is very attractive to the members, is because they realize that investments in it produce jobs and produce a healthy environment that promotes a sustainable economy. So I think that's why you see this sort of support.
And I think that's important to keep in mind, again, because we don't often think about that, partly because of the national conversation. You know, it might not be the greatest right now, just in terms of politics. And there's a lot of, I think, feelings that are still very raw right now. But what you're saying here is that progress is happening. And this initiative has been around for 14 years. This is very exciting. And Don, just kind of tying everything together here, you know, you have been involved in talking to government and working in environmental law for a long time now. But looking ahead here, I know that you are interested in training the next generation of environmental, you know, lawyers and those who are interested in the environment. And sometimes we forget it doesn't always have to be, you know, you're out in the middle of nowhere taking samples, although we are very thankful for those scientists who do those kinds of things and that work. That data is very, very important. But this is also a way, thinking about the law and thinking about government, where people can get involved if they're passionate about the environment and our future here on this planet. This is something, what you do and getting involved in this way, this is a real way to impact the environment, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what I do at the Alliance for the Great Lakes is I advocate. You know, I'm a program advocate for this program and others that protect and restore the lakes. And anybody can be an advocate for a program, whatever your interest is. You know, I taught environmental law at a couple of law schools, and I've taught classes on lobbying. And I get my basic point to people is that anybody can stand up and go to visit their congressional representatives, either locally or in Washington, or even over the telephone or through letters, and advocate for programs and things that you believe. And that's part of our system of government, is everybody has the capacity to do that. And I think that's a really good thing. And that's why I'm really grateful when I see a lot of sort of local community-oriented groups getting involved in protecting their resources, whether it's a river or a lake or a stream or a piece of habitat. You know, these sorts of local grassroots efforts are really important. In Washington, you know, they listen for that. People in government and people in the Congress, you know, that's important to them. You know, I was also in government for a long time, and, you know, local conservation efforts are extremely important to the health of our nation's environment. So I'm a big proponent of that.
And sometimes we feel like, oh, what's my voice going to do? What's my little sort of part here, my work going to do? But what you're saying is that does work. And people in the seat of power, they hear that. So I guess, you know, I was going to ask you, are you optimistic? I think it sounds like you are.
I am optimistic, you know, and I will say I do visits later in the year with Congress where I bring in folks from the region, especially folks that we work with. And I bring in some folks who have experienced, you know, lead service line replacement issues with their homes, or they may have been poisoned by the lead in their drinking water. I brought folks in who've had that experience, or folks from Toledo who lived through the shutoff of their water when there was a harmful algal bloom in Lake Erie and they couldn't get drinking water. So, you know, folks in Congress, they notice that. They really appreciate these personal stories and personal connections. So I'm always on the lookout for that sort of perspective, because I think it is incredibly powerful when you have people who can come in and tell their story of why the environment's important, and there may be something negative that's happening that needs to be addressed, but that's an important voice.
Absolutely. And I think the work continues, and our voices should continue to be out there advocating for our environment, because we only get one shot at this. And the website for the Alliance for the Great Lakes is greatlakes.org. And Don Jodry is the director of federal government relations at the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Hey, Don, I really appreciate the time. Thanks for all of your tremendous work. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
Mike, thank you. I really appreciate it. It was great to be with you today.
The Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
The trees in the country turn yellow and red, while the trees in the city turn black and fall dead. They whimper in the wind as they flutter and fall to the jungle of darkness that has it all. And it's a sea hill, we're coasting down to the cement valley of desperate town.
Oh yes, once again, connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Mr. Steve Krakow, who is the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader. And this week, Steve, you are profiling, I like the name here, Yama and the Karma Dusters. This is kind of like counterculture, underground, grow your hair really long, kind of sit in a circle kind of music vibe, right?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely were, you know, the sort of like 60s sort of groovy underground scene, which, you know, you don't hear about too much. You hear about like San Francisco, you know, you even hear about the East Coast some, but like you don't, you know, in the Warhol, in the factory or something, you know, but like you don't really hear about Chicago. And there was definitely this whole underground like art and, you know, sort of revolutionary weaning movement, you know, that was on. And then, you know, of course, there's always bands that sort of spring up to sort of be the sort of voice of this musically, or like MC5 and Detroit, and, you know, and obviously like Jefferson Airplane or something on the West Coast. And I mean, the Karma Duster sort of rose out of that to, and their album's called Up From the Sewers, so you know they rose up, you know, to sort of, you know, make their statement.
That's right. So we're talking about Yama and the Karma Dusters. And so you got the story from founding member Al Goldberg. He was born in Lawndale, raised in Bellwood in the 50s. And tell us about how he's coming up here, because he's pretty much a local guy.
Yeah. And he's still up in Rogers Park and very active, very cool dude. I got to admit, after talking to him, I had a little bit of a, if you're listening to Al, a little bit of an older man crush there. I was like, this guy is the coolest guy. And his recall was just like so, so great for surely what was a pretty heady scene, you know,
right,
shall we say. Recall was just amazing and, you know, just had great stories and still a percussionist up there. He still leads drum circles, as you were saying. He plays with Cantor Singers. Just a sort of pillar of the community, really, really cool dude. We'll go into a little more in a bit, I guess. But also similarly, he went to school in Champaign, University of Illinois, where I did. And then he transferred to UIC, the circle, as they called it, then, as my parents were there at about that exact same time, and my brother went there too. So some, you know, a little few life parallels as well. But yeah, super amazing guy. And out in Bellwood, he met this cat, Howard Berkman, who ended up starting a really cool garage band called The Knaves that I covered way, way back in Secret History. And at the time, believe he was still alive, and most of the members were, they all contacted me, and it was like, wow, this is cool, this is like, they're still out there, you know, because this was like in 2005 or something, you know, I kind of just started things, and I was like, wow, you know. So I always wondered about this band and sort of wanted to know the full story, and a really great reissue came out of the LP as well, with really good liner notes. So that was sort of like the final component in sort of getting the story on the post-Knaves Howard Berkman.
So, Berkman, you got Al Goldberg, and like you were saying, Goldberg transfers from U of I to UIC, and you say that he had an appointment with Destiny at the student union because there were couches all over the room, the hippies were hanging out on one of them, and people like Cynthia Plastercaster were in the fold here?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's like you realize how small these scenes were, you know, like no matter where you were. And like, yeah, they called it the couch. And I actually had to ask him, it says that in the liner. I was like, Al, what was the couch? He's like, oh, it was just this couch by the elevator on the second floor where all the hippies hung out. And I was like, oh, okay. And they called that the couch. And yeah, I was like, you know, basically future people that would be playing in the band. And yeah, you know, this small sort of scene, you know, that went to UIC, met there. And one day, you know, he's hanging out with this amazing keyboard player. You know, she's like, do you want to do a recording session with Howie Berkman, I guess, as they called him, Howie. And he's like, oh, yeah, hell yeah, let's do that, you know, or whatever. And then those sessions didn't necessarily go anywhere. They were trying to get Howard like sort of a recording contract. And by the time these sessions happened with all these folks on him, he was like, I like the band. You know, he's like, I don't want to do a solo thing or whatever. Cause I guess he was sort of between projects, and that more or less ended up for birthing what would become Yama and the Karma Dusters.
In terms of the music, like what we're listening to here, you know, it is kind of like that groovy underground, you know, kind of political activist kind of thing going on. But it has elements of folk to it. It's got elements of rock. It's got some really nice guitar work. And it's very pretty music, actually, when you think about it for this time. That's kind of where we're living here with the band Yama and the Karma Dusters.
Back to the city where I was born. Chicago. Goodbye, little country farm. You know the peace and quiet in the country just smothers up my mind. Yes, I have a rider. I believe I'm doing fine.
That's the thing, is this band was basically born, you know, and this, you know, more relevant today. They're very intertwined with the history of the time, and more or less out of the Kent State Massacre. Like, when that happened, that's what actually got the band performing live to play at a protest, actually. You know, they were like, we have to protest this. And it really, I mean, just reading statements from people that were there were like, you know, we were peace and love hippies, and then this happened. And all of a sudden, things got serious. You know, like, this wasn't, you know, like, we weren't going to sit around and talk about peace and love anymore. You know, like this was urgent, you know, suddenly now. And they felt the same thing, you know, and they obviously played this protest as their first show. And, you know, it sounds like that's a lot of what they did play, you know. And that said, you know, Al told me amazing stories of them opening for Howlin' Wolf.
That's amazing, you know,
and he loved them. And I was like, how did that audience, like, what did they think of you guys? He's like, oh, they loved us. You know, he's like, we were good musicians. And Howlin' Wolf loved Howie Berkman. He had like a little nickname for him and stuff. And like, so, you know, I mean, it was the times, it was a little bit too. But I think their charisma kind of comes through on the record, which, by the way, was, you know, pressed as like DIY proto punk rock as you could do it, basically put together on their kitchen table, you know.
Wow. Wow. Well, so, okay, this band, Yama and the Karma Dusters, they start to play. They are playing protests. They're playing in the 70s, the early 1970s. But tell us what happens here, because it's like they're on their way. They're playing. But what ends up happening to this band?
Okay. They weren't even called Yama and the Karma Dusters at first. They grew out of this thing called Euphoria Blimpworks. And that was technically a sound, the first, as far as I can figure, the first rock and roll sound company in Chicago. And the band sort of grew out of that group of people that ran the sound company, which was Al got involved with, which was the old salvaged equipment from the Kinetic Playground, which caught fire during the middle of a run. Okay, I'm sure you read this.
Yes.
King Crimson, Poco, and Iron Butterfly were doing a 3-day run at the Kinetic Playground. You know, my mind just kind of melted all over.
That is quite the bill.
Quite the bill. It's just, when I read that, it was like, what? Oh my, someone, you know, wake me up here. And caught fire, but it wasn't, the owner wanted to declare it a total loss for the insurance, basically. Mm-hmm. So they came and salvaged the equipment and started the first rock and roll sound company in Chicago. Basically, that became sort of a commune because everyone was just sort of hanging around. And then that sort of became the band. And then that sort of became Yama and the Karma Dusters. So it's a crazy genesis of how this band sort of started. But then, yeah, they were a sort of countercultural band. And they started kind of attracting the attention of the police. And a couple of them saw the writing on the wall and were like, maybe we should get out of here.
Yeah, they don't last too long. By the way, I love that there's a commune in the story. I mean, it wouldn't be counterculture if we didn't talk about a commune, but they were kind of doing that, living in a commune, which, you know, that's the thing.
Well, the commune thing, it's funny. They didn't really think of it that way. It was mostly just they would do these sound gigs. Everybody would crash there after, you know, at 3 a.m. after whatever, loading all the gear back home. Then the news, local news, no one can seem to remember exactly what station it was, did a thing about like alternative lifestyles, a special. And instead of filming they filmed everything there. But instead of that, they just showed a pretty girl sitting on Louis Favor's lap and talked about free love and showed the band for like 2 seconds. So all of a sudden, all these hippies were flocking to their commune, which they never really thought of as a commune. They're like, all right, I guess this is a commune. Basically, to the point that Al told me him and Howie Berkman had to move out you know, because there were so many people there, and they actually got a place on like Greenview, you know, because it was just like, yeah, it was like, you know, primitive lofts they had basically built on this. It was on Wacker, I believe. Yeah,
it was. This is quite the story. So the band, what ends up happening to people, some members of Yama and the Karma Dusters are going to pass away. But Al Goldberg, like you say, he's up in Rogers Park. A lot of, you know, hippies up there, former hippies, maybe current hippies up in Rogers Park. Very cool area. So he's doing his thing, and some other members are persisting as well.
Yeah, Karen still plays. She's like an educator in music. It seems like, so Howie Berkman, her, and Neil Pollock all went to like Colorado after like traipsing around the world and doing some different stuff. They all kind of went to Colorado, and Howard passed away. Neil's still around, as far as we know, and she teaches out there still and plays in a couple bands, as far as I can tell as well. So, and then, yeah, Al seems really, he co-founded the Glenwood Arts District in Rogers Park. Al did.
Yeah, they still have a festival up there.
My band played that festival.
Look at that, full circle.
It's really intertwined. I was like, wait a minute. You know, I don't want to make this all about me, but there's a lot in here that, you know, like when he actually told me that when I was interviewing, I'm like, wait a minute, Glenwood Arts Festival. Why have I heard of that? Oh yeah, my band played it in the middle of the pandemic. That's right. And we were thrilled because it was outdoor and we could play and it was like, wow, you know, but seems like a million years ago with every, you know, sort of everything that's gone on since then. But really cool dude. We might get coffee sometime and have a chat, maybe get some bagels or something.
Look at that. I love it when a plan comes together. And
yes.
We are learning about Yama and the Karma Dusters in this week's Secret History of Chicago Music Strip. It is in the Chicago Reader online at chicagoreader.com. And Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. He also hand draws a picture of who he's profiling. So you could check out a very trippy inverted picture, black and white here of Yama and the Karma Dusters. It looks great. Hey, Steve, I always appreciate it, man. And stay cool in your commune.
I'm going to stay frigid in mine.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 954 is done. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering skills in the WGN radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. Stay warm out there. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.